Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You know what the news calls you? Well, I know damn well you know.
Grand Reaper? Something.
The Grim Sleeper.
Oh, okay. I know it's something like that. Yeah, I saw it on TV.
That's Lonnie Franklin Jr. He's being interviewed by the LAPD on the day of his arrest. In speaking to serial killers, I've learned something important. Serial killers aren't born. They're made. They emerge from a perfect storm of circumstance, pressure, and opportunity.
Yes, I'd like to report a murder, a dead body, or something.
And nowhere is that clearer than the case of the Grim Sleeper.
All of these people that you say you don't know, through scientific evidence, are all pointing the finger at Lonnie David Franklin Jr.
Convicted of 10 murders, suspected of dozens more, maybe even hundreds. This is a monster hiding in plain sight.
How did this happen?
I feel like LAPD didn't care. I feel like at the end of the day, the government didn't care because it was a bunch of black women.
Walking in the footsteps of the Grim Sleeper and talking to the people who knew him best, it's obvious. Police have been looking at serial killers the wrong way. Not just in this case, in all of them. I'm James Buddy Day. This is Unmarked. When most people think of LA, they picture Hollywood, movie stars, the Hollywood sign, Malibu, Rodeo Drive. It's the postcard vision of palm trees lining Sunset Boulevard. I've probably spent more time in LA than in the city where I actually live. I've filmed many documentaries there and attended my fair share of Dodger games. But that's not Lonnie Franklin's LA. The Grim Sleeper stalks South Central, Inglewood, and Hawthorne. Lonnie Franklin lived right there on West 81st Street, tucked beside the LAX flight path, about a mile and a half from what is widely considered the only permanent open-air sex market in America.
I met the Grim Sleeper in 2009, well, no, 2000, like 2007, in between like 2007, 2009, and I dated him several times.
This is Dominique Smith. Like many of the witnesses, she still lives in the neighborhoods next to the airport. Dominique is one of dozens, maybe hundreds, of former sex workers who crossed paths with Lonnie Franklin over the 22 years leading up to his arrest. During that time, Franklin picked up hundreds of women and in many cases left their bodies in alleys, dumpsters, or unmarked places that will never be uncovered.
Prior to dating him, for me, the Grim Sleeper or Lonnie, I had heard about women being missing in that area. And there was like rumors about, you know, him hurting women. But there's always rumors about the track. So I didn't pay no mind because I was, you know, into the money part of it.
Lonnie never left South Central Los Angeles. He lived there, found his victims there, left dozens of bodies in his wake. And yet it took decades to identify him. Decades. The best place to start is 1974. Lonnie is 22 years old, stationed overseas with the U.S. Army in Stuttgart, West Germany. Lonnie isn't a big guy. He's about 5'9", African-American, not physically imposing, but intelligent, soft-spoken, and disarmingly ordinary. In the Army, he trains as a mechanic, a skill he'll use his entire life. But during his service, something significant happens, something that will cast a shadow over the rest of his life and eventually Los Angeles. This is Cliff Shepard, a former LAPD detective who worked on the Grim Sleeper Task Force, now retired.
We found out that Lonnie Franklin was stationed in Germany. He was in the Army. We found out that he was arrested for sexual assault of two German women back there. He and a couple of other Army personnel apparently picked the women up, took them out, and then sexually assaulted them.
The details of this incident will not become public until Lonnie's murder trial decades later. But according to court records, Private Lonnie Franklin Jr. and two other servicemen approach one, or possibly two women, I've heard different versions, but one of the victims is a 17-year-old girl. They offer her a ride, drive to a remote area, and as she'll later testify, they threaten her with a knife and assault her while one of the men photographs the attack. This is a defining moment for Lonnie. He'll spend the rest of his life trying to return to that night. Decades of criminology and forensic psychology show that for sexually violent offenders, these early assaults confuse violence with arousal. The first act becomes a blueprint, and later acts become attempts to recreate or intensify that original experience. This isn't nostalgia, it's conditioning. And with Lonnie, that conditioning becomes the emotional template that governs the next three decades of his life. He spends night after night, often with other men, picking up women, taking photos, inflicting suffering. But in 1974, nobody catches on. At the time, Lonnie already has a juvenile record. Suspicion of car theft, stealing property from a vehicle, probation, and the Army's internal investigation recommends a 3-year sentence. But Franklin only serves a year, for reasons the LAPD have never been able to determine.
He did serve some time, was released back to the United States, and came back to Los Angeles. I know in the mid-70s, 77 or so, he's back in his neighborhood.
When Franklin returns home, he finds a community beginning to fracture. And this is a reoccurring theme in serial killer investigations, something I've seen time and again. Chaotic moments create vulnerable populations, whether it's war or culture, and that's where men like Lonnie Franklin Jr. thrive. In this case, the chaotic moment is the 1980s crack cocaine epidemic.
Because of the advent of rock cocaine in the 80s, you saw an explosion of gangs growing, violence growing, and drugs. The rock cocaine was everywhere.
Walking around LA today, you can still see the scars. The faded mural half scrubbed off a liquor store wall. The strip of motels with boarded windows and hourly rates. The corners where memorial candles burned down. The bones of that era are still visible in the architecture, in the policing, in the way the neighborhoods talk about violence like it's weather.
It's funny because, like I said, I grew up in that neighborhood. Like, I grew up literally four blocks down. So, like that's the area I was in. Like, it's crazy. You make more money further down Western, for those who don't know.
That, again, is Dominique Smith. And what she's describing is the unique geography of South Central. You see, in the 80s, the influx of crack cocaine creates a vulnerable population of Black women. Hundreds of people battling addiction drift towards two parallel streets, Western and Figueroa. And this forms a dependable market for traffickers, dealers, and buyers. These two streets grow into one of the most visible tracks on the West Coast, still visible today. By the mid-80s, Lonnie spends most of his days in the front yard of his lime green family home. It's once owned by his parents, passed down to him. It's walking distance from where the victims are picked up and from where many of the bodies are eventually discovered. This again is Detective Cliff Shepard.
In his backyard, he had a garage. garage had like three stalls to it. He added one on it one time. Plus he had vehicles, including one RV, and he was entertaining women in the back of them.
Lonnie Franklin Jr. is married around this time, though despite two children, friends and neighbors recall the relationship barely existed. As early as the mid-80s, the couple lives largely separate lives.
I sort of figured back then maybe their marriage wasn't what it's supposed to be, and she had a job that kept her away from home.
That's Richard Harris. He lived across the street from Lonnie his entire life. They knew each other for decades.
She was a school principal. At what school, I don't know.
You have to form a picture of what Lonnie's life is like day to day. He doesn't work in a traditional sense. He survives on hustling and crime. Insurance fraud, drugs, trafficking in stolen goods, loan sharking, whatever brings in the cash.
I always thought it was because of the money he would have. He would always keep a stack of money. Hundreds, fifties. So maybe that's how he got his women in the car with him. Flashing money and drugs, because he always kept a handful of drugs.
Lonnie's crimes are tolerated, but they don't go unnoticed. Police records show that Lonnie is arrested at least 15 times. Car theft, burglary, receiving stolen property, assaults, firearm possession, grand theft auto, battery, assault likely to produce great bodily injury, false imprisonment, it's all there. He serves some brief prison sentences, but in his community, he's well known and well funded.
He would buy cars and from insurance auctions, totaled out cars, and have his crew go steal a car just like it and take the parts off of it and sell his car for practically new.
Because of the criminal hustle, Lonnie is wealthy by neighborhood standards. He employs people. Folks come to his house every day. His backyard is a maze of cars and junk, but people in the community, those who knew him, they remember him fondly.
Lonnie was perceived as a nice guy. He was a really nice guy to live in your neighborhood. He would fix your cars for free if he knew you. He wouldn't charge you anything for fixing your car. If you needed to buy a car from him, he would charge you a little bit of nothing.
At night, when his neighbors are asleep, Lonnie cruises the blade. He rotates through cars, sometimes an orange Pinto, other times a large blue and white church van he converts with a mattress and a tripod in the back. And just like his 1974 conviction in Germany, he's not alone. He picks up sex workers alongside other men, and he photographs the encounters.
Nani was very weird. He was like, he bragged a lot on girls that he had, girls that he meet, girls that he picked up, girls that he had sex with. He kept a photo album of a lot of women. He would show us albums and albums. He had stacks of them. Somebody out of the group would always say they know this girl, that girl. And sometimes it made me feel that maybe he's doing this to see if we knew any of them.
I want to be clear. As far as we know, Lonnie commits the murders alone, even though he gets a thrill out of including others on the margins.
I do carpet and linoleum, and I used to clean the carpet in his mobile home. He had a miniature mobile home. And I used to clean carpet, and I cleaned his carpet, and it looked like, he said it was oil stains, but it didn't clean like oil stains because it wouldn't come out. It seems like it was blood stains in the carpet.
The scary truth is that no one knows when Lonnie truly begins to kill women or how many murders he commits during those early years. For example, as early as 1982, on June 9th, a woman named Catherine Davis is struggling with addiction and sex work. She's last seen one block from Figueroa, never seen again. And Davis has never been officially tied to Lonnie Franklin Jr., but people in the neighborhood, including her family, believe she was one of the victims. And she's not the only one. Even though, according to official records, Franklin's first known victim isn't until 2 years later, we know that in the years leading up, Lonnie is living in his parents' house halfway between Western and Figueroa, working as a garbage collector.
When we first met Lonnie, he was on the trash truck. That's when I first noticed him. He was doing the trash back when the trash man was on the back of the truck and had to jump off and dump the trash can.
There's a persistent belief among neighbors and investigators that some of Lonnie's victims may still be buried inside the massive Los Angeles landfill system in unmarked graves. But we know from DNA that Lonnie killed a woman in 1984. On January 15th, Franklin picks up 21-year-old Sharon Dismuke. Franklin is 31 at the time. Her body is found at an abandoned gas station, shot twice, gagged, and left on the concrete. At the time, the investigation is minimal. Police don't even realize she's a victim in the Grim Sleeper case until more than 20 years later when she's connected through ballistics when the murder weapon is found inside Lonnie's bedroom. DNA also confirms Lonnie murdered 29-year-old Deborah Jackson on August 10th, 1985. Police find the body in an alley near West Gage Avenue, two blocks from Figueroa. She's shot three times in the chest. By this point, more than a dozen women have gone missing from Western and Fig, many not even properly documented as missing.
Mr. Franklin, you have a major problem.
That's LAPD Detective Dennis Kilcoyne speaking to Lonnie on the day of his arrest 20 years later. He describes the simple truth it will take investigators decades to figure out.
You've had this problem, for at least that we're aware of, for 25 years. You creep out. You pick up these young ladies that are out working Western or Figueroa or whatever in the middle of the night. You have sex with them. You kill them. And then you dump their bodies in alleys throughout the city of Los Angeles. Most of them near, not too far from your house.
The tragedy of this situation is that if police had thoroughly investigated even one of those early murders, if they had interviewed the women on Western and Fig, listened, recognized them as a vulnerable population, paid closer attention to the geography and the fragile communities around it, the trail would have led right to Lonnie's house decades earlier.
All these victims had been shot. All of them but one were female. All shot with a 25 caliber bullet. And the bullets were compared and thought to be fired from the same gun. So after about the second murder, our firearms unit and detectives from those divisions, and one was 77th, said, okay, it looks like we've got a serial murder out there.
At that point, the LAPD established a task force. They call these cases the Strawberry Murders.
Well, a woman that does anything for drugs, such as sexual favors and stuff like that, is known as a strawberry.
It's a surprising lack of respect for the victims in hindsight, and perhaps it contributes to the fact that the task force stalls almost immediately, really for two major reasons. First, there's no consensus on how many women are missing. Many disappearances aren't reported, others are dismissed or misclassified. Countless cases fall through the cracks. Second, at this time, there are at least seven serial killers operating around Western and Fig. Seven. In the period we're talking about, Daniel Lee Siebert, Lewis Crane, Ivan Hill, Michael Hughes, and Chester Dwayne Turner are all operating on the stretch of road so small you could drive it in about 10 minutes. In fact, it was originally believed that all these men, including Lonnie, were one person dubbed the Southside Slayer. And by 1987, when the task force is abandoned, four of these men have been arrested. And it leaves police with the false impression that no one else is out there. This is a phenomenon I've seen many times in these cases, and it's called case clearance pressure. Police departments are judged heavily on clearance rates. So once a high-profile offender is arrested, and in this case, they arrested four, there's a lot of pressure to close other open cases and reassure the public. That pressure creates this perverse incentive. Assign unsolved murders to the offender already in custody, even when the evidence doesn't fully match. Over my career, I have seen this repeatedly. Wayne Williams, Henry Lee Lucas, even the Zodiac Killer, all include cases lumped in that clearly belong to someone else. And ironically, this is where the name The Grim Sleeper comes from. But it isn't police who coin it, it's LA Weekly. reporters interpret missing and incomplete data to be long gaps or sleeps between murders and assume the killer went dormant. But that isn't what happened.
We, the LAPD, have been blasted over the years for not caring for the people, not caring about the victims, and ignoring what's happening. That is not true. Problem is, it's a city of 465 square miles, over 3 million, 3.5 million people, and we have a lot of crime. In the 90s, we were hitting over 1,000 murders a year. That's, you know, three people a day, depending what area you are. And I'm aware of murders, three murders occurring in one day in South Los Angeles. So you only have so much manpower that you can devote to it. So much
money. This is the environment Lonnie thrives in, a chaotic landscape where vulnerable people are overlooked and where a predator blends into the noise.
Yes, I'd like to report a murder, a dead body or something.
Correct.
The address is 1346 East 56th Street in the alley. And the guy that dropped her off was driving a white and blue Dodge van.
That is the 911 call from January 10th, 1987, 30 minutes after Lonnie Franklin Jr. leaves the body of Barbara Ware in an alley. She's 23, later confirmed through DNA. And she isn't the only victim we know about. Lonnie kills Henrietta Wright, 35, on August 12th, 1986. And it goes on and on and on. Bernita Sparks tells her mother she's going to buy cigarettes. She never returns. She's later found shot to death with Lonnie's .25 caliber semi-automatic pistol on April 15th, 1987. Mary Lowe, 26, tells her mother she's going to a Halloween party. She's later discovered shot. Investigators believe she's killed on or around November 1st, 1987. Then, on January 30th, 1988, Lonnie murders Latricia Jefferson, shot with the same .25 caliber pistol, later tied to Lonnie through ballistic evidence. 8 months later, on September 8th, 1988, he murders Alicia Alexander, again with the same handgun. This is by no means a comprehensive list. There are many families still in South Los Angeles who believe their loved ones were killed by Lonnie Franklin Jr., but never connected to his case officially. Possible victim Rosalind Gillies is last seen on January 10th, 1991, never heard from again. Another possible victim, Lisa Renee Knox, disappears on May 11th, 1993, never found. Another possible victim, Anita Parker, vanishes on November 17th, 1998, never found.
I feel like LAPD didn't care. I feel like at the end of the day, the government didn't care because it was a bunch of black women. So had it been anywhere else, it would have been televised more.
We have every reason to believe many of these women fell victim to Lonnie Franklin Jr. After his arrest, detectives uncover more than 1,000 photographs and hundreds of hours of video inside his home. These images show women in disturbing poses, and some are seemingly unconscious. And then there are the survivors. Many women survived violent or disturbing encounters with Franklin during this time. For example, on November 20th, 1988, Franklin shoots in Trio, Washington, with the same .25 caliber gun, but she survives. She becomes a key witness in the case, but even though she leads police right to Lonnie's street, where Lonnie is frequently standing out front of his house with the .25 caliber pistol in his pocket, the LAPD comes up empty. Here is LAPD Detective Paul Coulter interviewing Lonnie years later after his arrest. In the video, Lonnie denies owning the .25 caliber handgun found in his home and used in many of the murders.
You don't own any more handguns?
No, no.
What about that .25 caliber there in your closet?
A pistol?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, over the... That's not mine.
It's not?
No, that's my brother-in-law's. We just picked that his stuff last week.
If police had performed a targeted geographic search or gone door-to-door, they likely would have found Lonnie years earlier, which makes sense because of a discipline called geographic profiling. This is what we've been getting wrong about serial killers. Research shows that most serial killers commit their crimes within 5 miles of their home. One major study of 54 serial killers found that 87% of their crimes fell within that radius. With geographic profiling, the idea is simple. Offenders choose locations they know, the alleys they cut through, the corners they watch, the places where they feel invisible. Victim encounters, attack sites, disposal points, they all fall within this little comfort zone. And get this, using conventional profiling, the FBI has claimed that there are maybe 50 serial killers in the United States at any given time. But using geographic profiling and DNA links, one research group, the Murder Accountability Project, has shown there are over 2,000 active serial killers in the U.S. But in the 80s and 90s, the LAPD never connects these dots. They think he's sleeping. They think he's stopped. They're wrong, but they don't wake up until 2007. By that time, California has completely overhauled its DNA laws. What was once collected only for violent felony cases is expanded to all felony convictions and eventually all felony arrests under Proposition 69 in 2004. The state also clears out a backlog of untested evidence and requires new DNA samples to be uploaded into the federal system. These reforms transform California's DNA archive from a modest collection into one of the largest in the country, and almost overnight, cold cases across the state begin getting solved at a rapid rate. But despite being arrested dozens of times, the LAPD never collects Lonnie Franklin Jr.'s DNA. In 2003, Lonnie is even charged with a felony that requires a mandatory DNA sample. But despite a lifetime record of violence, he is allowed to plead it down to a misdemeanor, avoiding DNA collection entirely. This means Lonnie is on probation when he commits many of the murders.
Now let me give you an incident when I met Lonnie.
This is Pamela Brooks, another former sex worker who encountered Lonnie in 2007.
So he came down in his van one day and he kept circling the block.
According to Pamela, she goes with Lonnie into the back of his van where he asks her to wear a collar and pose for him.
You know, talking like, well, we really don't have to do anything. I want you to start being like barking, act like a dog.
Pamela refuses. And when Lonnie isn't paying attention, she slips out and walks away before he can follow. It's a decision that may have saved her life.
But I didn't know he was a crib sleeper until it all came out the wash. You know what I'm saying?
On January 1st, 2007, the body of 25-year-old Janisa Peters is discovered on the 9500 block of Southwestern Avenue by a homeless man searching dumpsters for cans.
Dumpster was a little bit different from the original location. It was down maybe a building, but it was still there, right there in that alley. I mean, so this guy is using these alleys. He's familiar with these alleys.
LAPD Police Chief Bill Bratton convenes the 800 Task Force, a specialized investigative team assembled to solve what they wrongly believe is only 11 unsolved murders dating back to 1985.
Two of the women, Bernita Sparks and, I don't recall the other one offhand, they were found in dumpsters around 95th Street and Western, about 10 years apart. We had a DNA profile for our guy. We had him on about 6 murders that connected him from murders from the 80s to 2007.
But Lonnie has more victims than anyone realizes. Georgia Mae Thomas, 43, is found fatally shot on December 18th, 2000, just a mile from where Barbara Ware was left. Ballistics match the weapon to multiple other victims. Princess Bartholomew, 15, disappears in December 2001. She's found strangled and beaten in an Inglewood alley. DNA from her body links directly to Lonnie. In July 2003, a crossing guard in Westmont discovers the body of Valerie McCorvey, 35. She has trauma to the neck.
2002, this young lady was then. Do you recognize her?
No, I don't.
Princess. Never seen her before? Okay, in 2003, this young lady was found killed. Have you ever seen her?
No, I haven't.
You don't know that lady?
No, I don't.
You've never seen her?
No, I haven't. I haven't.
Mr. Franklin, just like the other one, your DNA was found on this young lady. Okay. Is there a way to explain that?
No, it's not.
There's no
way. I don't know this lady.
Two more women, Aaliyah Marshall, 18, missing since 2006, and Rolina Morris, 31, missing since 2005. Neither are found, but Marshall's student ID and Morris's driver's license and photo are later found inside a refrigerator in Lonnie's garage. When Lonnie is arrested in 2010, the LAPD describes it as a, quote, painstaking process, claiming detectives undertook, quote, revolutionary DNA work to finally solve the case. This is not true. The LAPD caught Lonnie Franklin Jr. completely by accident. In 2010, Lonnie's son Christopher is arrested on an unrelated felony charge. When Christopher's DNA is uploaded into the state database, it triggers a familial match to the Grim Sleeper murders. At the time, Christopher is living with Lonnie at the house on West 81st Street. Detectives trail Lonnie, knowing that he's Christopher's father. They wait for him to discard something with his DNA on it. When he throws away a piece of pizza crust, they recover it, test it, and it matches the Grim Sleeper profile. This is how the case breaks.
We had guys watching him. We'd have him, he was going to Western Avenue and approaching women on Western Avenue. Presented a problem for us because we didn't want him picking up a woman on Western Avenue or anywhere else at that time. We couldn't let that happen. So we're trying to make a decision. What are we going to do if he does that or tries?
Franklin is taken into custody on July 7th, 2010. That morning, LAPD surveillance teams watch him leave the house, unaware that detectives already have his DNA from the discarded pizza slice. As he returns home later that afternoon, officers move in. He's surrounded in his driveway and arrested without a struggle. The end of a 25-year killing spree hidden in plain sight.
One day the LAPD showed up and we thought it was for the stolen cars, but it wasn't because they had the crime lab. When the crime lab showed up, we really knew it wasn't. Then one of the officers, the LAPD officers, explained to us that it was that Lonnie Franklin was arrested for multiple murders.
Inside the house, detectives finally see what Lonnie has been hiding.
When we served the search warrant on his house, we did a quick walkthrough once we got everybody out to get an idea what where we're going to examine and who's going to be assigned to what area and what search. He had an office, a bedroom. He had a closet, and inside the closet, I opened it up. There was a military jacket in there. I patted the military jacket. I could feel there was a gun in the pocket. I didn't pull it out, and I said, "We'll wait for the search team to let them find it." But I'm certain it was going to be a gun.
The home is filled with piles of belongings. There's magazines, junk, household debris, and buried within are troves of pornography, sex toys, homemade tapes, objects belonging to victims, and photographs of more than 180 women in various states.
In his garage, one of the teams was going through holes in the areas in the garage and reached in and pulled out a handful of photographs of women in disrobing.
This again is Dominique Smith, who encountered Lonnie in 2007.
I felt hurt because maybe if I would have said something to somebody, I probably could have saved a life. I was hurt because, like, just not caring enough to know who's around me or what I'm doing or what predator I'm sleeping with. That's where the hurt really came from. Like, I knew this man was a pervert. I knew he was weird. And here you go, he a killer.
The same day of his arrest, Lonnie is interviewed by LAPD detectives.
Let me ask you something. Do you know what DNA is?
Yes, the blood, saliva, anything, any body fluids that make contact.
Okay, and it's like a fingerprint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, only one person has that DNA.
Okay, so you understand it probably better than I do.
Yeah, I understand, but I don't know these people. So, yeah, you got 5 or 6 people here. Well, and I don't
so far.
Yeah.
He says little and asks for a lawyer after about 40 minutes. Ending the interview. And it will take 6 years before Lonnie David Franklin Jr., the man now known as the Grim Sleeper, is convicted of 10 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of attempted murder. He's sentenced to death, but before that sentence can be carried out, he dies in prison before all the questions can be answered. The Grim Sleeper is found unresponsive in his cell on March 28th, 2020, at the age of 67. Prison staff attempt to revive him. He's pronounced dead shortly thereafter. There are no signs of trauma found on his body, suggesting he dies of natural causes.
When I heard that Lonnie had died in prison, I thought, okay, well, California won't make sure justice is done, but God did. So he'll never kill anybody else. We're done here.
For decades, we've looked at serial killers the wrong way. Most of these people are not Hannibal Lecter. They're not geniuses. For the most part, not even drifters moving across state lines. They're the people living among us. Neighbors, co-workers, the man fixing the car in his backyard down the street. And the Grim Sleeper case shows exactly what this blind spot looks like. Lonnie Franklin Jr. is not a criminal mastermind. He's a man who operated for decades inside a few square miles because the victims were vulnerable, the investigations under-resourced, and the community's warnings ignored. The lesson from this case isn't about how one killer got away. It's about how many others we fail to see. If we want to stop the next Grim Sleeper, the answers won't come from profiling cliches or Hollywood tropes. They'll come from the ground level. From listening to the people who are most at risk, the people whose lives and deaths rarely make the news. Because the truth is, serial killers don't vanish. We just fail to look in the right places. And when we do, the map lights up. If you go to our social channels, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram, you'll see additional content about this episode, more phone calls, insights, and interviews. And we'll be posting daily from the last decade of our true crime reporting. This season on Unmarked, you'll hear exclusive audio and interviews, calls, and content, including the last interview with Charles Manson. We're opening our archives one case at a time. Subscribe to Unmarked so you don't miss what we reveal next. This episode of Unmarked is produced by John Nadeau, edited by Dave Alderson, and our additional producers are Jesse Demaray and Steve McClellan.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.